Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, February 17th. For people who have gotten fully vaccinated, the Centers for Disease Control have an interesting and hopeful new guideline. If you are vaccinated and then exposed to someone with COVID-19, you don't necessarily have to quarantine. Now, that implies that the vaccine might make you less able to transmit the virus, which has been a question. The vaccine might protect you from getting really sick. We know that pretty well by now. But does it prevent you from actually getting and spreading the virus? We'll see with our guest if we can get any more clarity on that. So with those stories as prelude, with us now is our guest, Dr. Dhruv Kuller, a practicing physician and professor at the Weill Cornell Medical College. His research focuses on topics including health disparities and medical innovation. He's also a New Yorker magazine staff writer whose latest article is called "Why Are So Many Healthcare Workers Resisting the Coronavirus Vaccine?" The one before that is called "Biden's Pandemic Plan Just Might Work." Dr. Kuller, so glad you could join us today. Welcome to WNYC.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So I'll bite on your latest headline. Why are so many healthcare workers, of all people, resisting the coronavirus vaccine?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brian. One of the things that kind of surprised me, and I think surprised a lot of people early on, you know, on the one hand, you have so many people, as your caller's email suggested, who are really trying to get the vaccine and unable to get it. On the other hand, we started hearing reports that even some healthcare workers were expressing vaccine hesitancy, that they weren't jumping at the opportunity to get vaccinated. And so I wanted to try to understand why this was the case. So I spoke to a number of doctors and nurses, as well as nursing aides, people who worked in nursing homes. And I think it really came down to a few different issues. One was that some people felt that the vaccine had just been developed too quickly. And so we had been told for a long time that vaccines can take months or years or decades to be developed. And this one, these vaccines came out in less than a year. Some people were concerned about the side effects of the vaccines. But I think the driving force in a lot of examples, particularly for people who worked in nursing homes, was a lack of trust, a lack of trust in the motives of the people that were asking them to get vaccinated, having felt that the health system hadn't treated them as well as they thought they deserved to be treated over the years. And so they simply didn't trust that the vaccine was effective. Now, we know that the vaccine is effective. We have a lot of work to do to convince both healthcare workers, but also the general public, that it is safe, it is something that is life-saving, and that is important to get. But those are some of the reasons that I think people initially had some level of skepticism. I think that will improve over time, but we have a lot of work to do in that area as well.
And Dr. Kuller, some of the stories you tell in your article are of healthcare workers who simply don't trust their employers, like cases of being lied to in the past about whether they would have to be around COVID patients in certain assignments. They were told no, and it turned out to be yes. How much of a factor do you think that is?
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's a big issue around trust. And I think there's the issue that you highlighted, that people weren't always told that they would be caring for COVID patients. There's the issue that people haven't always had the PPE, the mask, the goggles, the gowns that they needed. They haven't received hazard pay. They haven't been paid well in the past. And all these things kind of contribute to an environment in which some staff can feel that their best interests aren't at heart, that certain entities, whether it's hospitals or nursing homes, may value profits over the interests of patients or of staff. You know, I should note here that we talk about healthcare workers as a large kind of homogenous group, but that's not at all the case, obviously. There are doctors, nurses, there are people that help transport patients, there are the cleaning staff in hospitals. And so what we see is that healthcare workers have different levels of vaccine hesitancy depending on their role and depending on the setting in which they are working. And so Nursing homes seem to have somewhat higher levels of vaccine hesitancy as compared to hospitals. People who work in relatively lower paying jobs in the healthcare system, people who are transporting patients, people who are working in food services or cleaning rooms or nursing assistants, they also have higher levels of vaccine hesitancy. And then obviously we see disparities by race. And so there are a number of historical reasons for that, but also current reasons that people feel like they have been marginalized, or they haven't, their interests haven't been valued by the system. And so all those things are contributing to levels of vaccine hesitancy. You know, I will note that that I think this will improve over time. I think one thing that we heard a lot early on is that people simply wanted to see how their colleagues did after they got vaccinated. People wanted to understand, you know, when the general public is starting to get vaccinated, how do they do in terms of side effects, in terms of the protection that they receive after they're vaccinated. As those things become clearer and clearer to people, I think more and more people will decide to get the vaccine ultimately.
So before we go to some phone callers, let's go on to the new CDC guidelines for people who have been fully vaccinated. The CDC is still urging vaccinated people to keep taking most of the usual precautions, as I understand it, like wearing masks and social distancing. But a few days ago said vaccinated folks should not have to quarantine if they're exposed to someone who's COVID positive. So I'm really confused how those different pieces of advice fit together. You do have to keep masking and social distancing, but if you're exposed, you don't have to quarantine. How much can you explain it?
Yeah, so the CDC has laid out a few criteria for people who are fully vaccinated not to quarantine after a coronavirus exposure. And so they say you have to be at least 2 weeks after your second dose of the coronavirus vaccine. That is the time at which we expect that your immune system has matured and has delivered some level of protection or full protection, nearly full protection against infection. So you have to be 2 weeks out. The other thing that they said is that you have to be less than three months out. So between 2 weeks and 3 months. And the reason for that second piece is that it's not yet clear how long immunity lasts after you've been vaccinated. So you have to be somewhere in that time frame. And the third part of this is that you can't have experienced any symptoms. So if you start to feel symptoms, cough, fatigue, runny nose, those would all be suggestions that you may be having symptomatic COVID-19 and therefore should enter a quarantine. So assuming that you meet all these criteria, the rationale here seems to be that fully vaccinated people can feel a lot safer, that they are protected against severe disease. And while there is a theoretical risk that they can still contract the virus and potentially spread the virus, that is not high enough in their estimation at this point to offset the kind of social and economic problems that occur from quarantines. And so the idea here is that you still need to take precautions when you go out in public, but you're assuming that if you are asymptomatic, the risk of spreading it to others is less than if you become symptomatic. So it's kind of trying to walk a tight balance here. But the idea is, you know, you have been vaccinated. The risk of you then contracting and transmitting the virus, especially if you're asymptomatic, is relatively low.
What's the best science to date on whether the vaccine reduces your ability to transmit the virus to others?
You know, that is still an open question. I think there, theoretically, most scientists would say that it's the risk that you would contract and transmit the virus is lower, much lower after you've been vaccinated as compared to before you've been vaccinated. We've seen some suggestion in terms of declining case rates in areas with where you've had higher vaccination. Israel is a good example of this. That would suggest that indeed, not only are you protected from getting severe disease, but you also have a lower ability to transmit the virus. But there's still a lot of uncertainty around this question. And so until we know the answer to that, the most important things that we need to do still exist in terms of masking and social distancing, avoiding large indoor gatherings. I hope that we have an answer to this question in the coming weeks and months, but right now we just don't have enough science around it.
Claire in Sleepy Hollow, you're on WNYC with Dr. Dhruv Kular from Cornell Weill and The New Yorker. Hi.
Morning, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. My husband and I both had coronavirus after a fire in our house on Christmas Day. We think that's where we might have gotten it. And both of us are recovering. Thank goodness they were relatively mild cases. And by relatively, I really mean relatively. my question is the reaction that people in my circle seem to be having after the second shot sounds like an immunological reaction, but my understanding is that this is not a live virus in the vaccine, and after that, my science falls apart, but I know it's an RNA vaccination. Can you explain how it causes that immunological reaction in people if it's not live virus?
Right, meaning some people feel sick for a day or a couple of days after getting usually the second dose. That's an immunological response, Dr. Kular. Can you fully further explain that to Claire?
Sure. First of all, Claire, I'm sorry to hear about the fire and the coronavirus infection that you and your husband had, but I'm glad that you're feeling okay now. So you're absolutely right. So it's not a live virus that the vaccine is using. It's this new technology called mRNA platform technology. And the idea is that it takes the genetic code, it takes some of the genetic material of the virus, the same kind of printout you could think of, and kind of delivers it to your cells. And it gets your cell to make a specific type of protein. That protein is very similar to the type of protein that the virus itself, a real virus, would introduce, but it's not the real virus's protein. It's a protein that it has the mRNA technology has asked your cells to make. And that protein is what inspires the immune response in your body. So your body starts reacting as if you have the live virus, but it is not the live virus, it's this protein. But the symptoms that one feels from that type of immune response are very similar. And so that's the reason that even though the virus is not in your body, it can feel like your immune system is reacting in the same way.
Claire,
and just a quick...
Go ahead. You have a follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up question. Thank you so much, Brian. Is that why they're thinking it might also protect against the other mutations of this virus? And then I'll go off the air. Thank you both so much.
Yeah. So the idea is that when the spike protein is kind of introduced, your body makes many different types of antibodies. So it's not as if it makes just one antibody in response to the vaccine. It makes many types of antibodies. Each may be slightly different than the others. And so it is able to neutralize slightly different versions of the virus, whether it has a mutation on this part of the virus or that part of the virus. And that's the idea behind having kind of what we call many types antibody response. Yeah, there is some evidence, particularly with the South Africa strain, that certain vaccines may not be as effective against it. It may have developed some type of mutation that actually renders it somewhat more resistant to particular types of vaccines. But for the most part, the vaccines seem to be effective against the viruses and the variants that we know of to date.
Nellie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Dr. Kular. Hi, Nellie.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a kind of follow-up question, actually, to Claire's, where my mom's in her 70s, and she had COVID, and then got the first vaccine and is waiting for the second, and she tested positive for antibodies. And I'm just curious, like, there hasn't been a lot of talk about the difference in immunity between the vaccine and actually having the illness and the antibodies from the illness. And she's walking around like she's Superwoman. she's masked and she's doing socially distanced, but she's definitely alleviating some of the barriers and opening her germ circle a bit. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about the difference between that immunity and whether or not you should live your life differently depending on whether or not you have immunity from the vaccine or immunity from the illness.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we don't know enough about the differences at this time between naturally acquired immunity and vaccine-generated immunity. We do have a recommendation from the CDC that people who have had the infection should also still get vaccinated. And the idea being we don't know how long naturally acquired immunity lasts, and we don't know how robust that response is as compared to the vaccine-generated response. You know, I think the short answer is both people who have had naturally acquired immunity or vaccine-generated immunity probably have a greater level of protection for themselves, but when they're still out in public, need to be doing the things that you said your mom is doing, which is continuing to wear masks, continuing to exercise social distance until enough of us have the vaccine, have protection, such that it's safe for people to be out together in larger groups.
Nellie, thanks. You know, I was speaking to a healthcare worker who's over 60 and has been fully vaccinated, and the impression I got is that the old story of who's protecting who in somebody's family has flipped. So the person used to avoid his grandchildren, so he didn't get the virus with his risk of serious illness from being over 60. Now he's concerned about seeing his grandchildren for fear of exposing them because he could be safe from getting sick, but still be a carrier. So with the elderly being the most vaccinated group for the moment, has society kind of switched places generationally on who's protecting who?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's what, you know, it's an interesting thing that has happened by virtue of people who are in the older age group initially being the most vulnerable and now potentially being the most protected. You know, I think, you know, the hope is that over time, more and more younger people are getting vaccinated. My other hope is that, you know, the science bears out that it's unlikely that people who are vaccinated are able to transmit the virus. But until that time, you know, the kind of scenario that you laid out is certainly true, and that people who have been vaccinated are themselves safe, but we can't say one way or another just yet whether or not they can transmit it to others.
So about the variants, you know, Dr. Lena Wen in her Washington Post column today says the guidance is so confusing from the government that she's had vaccinated patients who've discarded their masks and gone bar hopping, and she could see how others would ask, what's the point of getting vaccinated at all if you can't really open your life back up? And I guess by implication, one of the reasons for that concern and not fully opening your life back up is that we don't know yet the science of how much the vaccine protects against the new variants. So what's your behavioral advice in light of that? And when do you think we'll really know?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that we need to help people have during this period, I mean, we're a year into the pandemic and people are kind of understandably frustrated and need some level of hope. And so I think we need to be clear about the benefits and the unknowns around the vaccines. And the benefits are profound. I mean, people who are vaccinated have much, much lower levels of risk for severe disease, for hospitalization, for death. They can be much more confident that they're safe, even at this time, as far as we know from the variants. We need to get as many people vaccinated as possible in order to prevent the emergence of new variants. We know that variants are more likely to emerge in countries and in places where there's a rampant spread of the virus. So those public health measures are still important for tamping down the ability of new variants to emerge. And people who are vaccinated, if two or three or four people are vaccinated, they can feel more comfortable gathering in a way that they weren't before. That's not to say that they should completely throw caution to the wind, or when they're around unvaccinated people, they should still not take all the public health measures that are needed. But as more and more people get vaccinated, have that level of protection, we need to give people hope and hope that's based in science that that life will get better and we will reach a place where we will be much, much closer to normal than we are today.
Before you go, your article in The New Yorker, Biden's pandemic plan just might work. That's his plan to speed up delivery of vaccines, right?
It is. I mean, a lot of it has to do with speeding up the number of vaccines that are being delivered. But there are other parts of the plan as well, in terms of mobilizing federal resources to make sure that we have enough masks, that we have enough kind of other protective equipment, working with governors to introduce things like mask mandates and other public health measures, but really putting the muscle of the federal government behind erecting new vaccination centers, giving states the support that they need to get as many shots and as many arms as possible, and really start to turn the corner on this pandemic.
So how long, or what do you see as the just might work part and the hardest parts of that to make succeed?
Yeah, you know, I think there's still a long way to go in terms of getting hundreds of millions of doses into Americans' arms. All along the way, in addition to getting people vaccinated, as you mentioned, it's hard to get people to continue to adhere to public health guidance, whether it's masks or distance or changing their lives in pretty fundamental ways as they see these vaccines getting rolled out. I think that by the end of summer, life will be much, much closer to normal. I hope that, you know, when we start the new school year, we're essentially back to a place where everyone is back in school and teachers feel safe and students feel safe. And so I think later this year, we're going to get to a place where we see something close to normal. But there's a lot of work to be done between today and that moment.
Dr. Dhruv Kuller, a practicing physician and professor at the Weill Cornell Medical College, and a New Yorker staff writer. His latest articles are Biden's Pandemic Plan Just Might Work and Why Are So Many Healthcare Workers Resisting the Coronavirus Vaccine. Dr. Kuller, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.